Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, October 2, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, as today we discuss three consolidated cases, Epic States, Murphy Oil, and Ernst & Young. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. We're happy to welcome a new guest to teleforum conference call. He is Edward F. Barbari. He's a shareholder at the Littler Mendelson Law Firm out of the Dallas office, although he was here in Washington, D.C. today to attend oral argument and report back to us. Now, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on the call today, and also this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. With that, sir, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and thank you to everyone for getting on this call. I'm very excited and happy to be here speaking with you, and was very excited to attend the oral argument today, where three cases were heard today by the United States Supreme Court involving the issue of whether or not express class action waivers contained within arbitration agreements, which are governed by the Federal Arbitration Act, are enforceable notwithstanding the protections provided by the National Labor Relations Act to non-supervisory employees. You've got the Ernst & Young case that came up through the Ninth Circuit, where the Ninth Circuit sided with the NLRB's opinion that class action waivers violate non-supervisory employees' Section 7 rights under the National Labor Relations Act to engage in protected concerted activity. Also heard was the Epic Systems case that came up through the Seventh Circuit, which also sided with the NLRB's position that class actions are a form of protected concerted activity under the National Labor Relations Act and therefore can't be waived even in an arbitration agreement governed by the Federal Arbitration Act. And then you had the Murphy Oil case, which came up through the Fifth Circuit, and is the only case that actually had the National Labor Relations Board as a party in that case. And in the Murphy Oil case, the Fifth Circuit rejected the analysis of the NLRB and found that notwithstanding the National Labor Relations Act protections of concerted activity, an FAA-governed arbitration agreement with a class waiver must still be enforced according to its terms. I can tell you it was an exciting and interesting argument. On behalf of the employers and arguing for the employer's position in this case, you had Paul Clement arguing on behalf of the private employers. You also had, interestingly, the Solicitor General arguing on behalf of the employers in this case as well. You know, the interesting side note to this case was that prior to the election, the Solicitor General was representing the National Labor Relations Board in this case and advocating for the National Labor Relations Board's position. And the Solicitor General, when amicus briefs were due, the Solicitor General filed an amicus brief in support of the employer's position and then filed a motion to be able to argue on behalf of the United States and for the employers that class waivers should be enforceable in the employment context. So one lawyer representing the private employers at oral arguments, the Solicitor General advocating on behalf of the employers in this case. Then you had the General Counsel of the National Labor Relations Board arguing on behalf of the National Labor Relations Board's position. And then another private attorney, Mr. Ortiz, arguing on behalf of the employees in this case. A large part, or at least a good part of the argument, focused upon whether or not class and collective actions are in fact protected concerted activity under the National Labor Relations Act. In fact, it was the first question right out of the gate that the lawyer for the employers was asked, and I believe it was Justice Kennedy that asked him about it. And I can tell you that there is no doubt, after listening to the oral argument that Justice Ginsburg, Justice Kagan, Justice Breyer, and Justice Sotomayor all believe that it's a no-brainer that class and collective actions are protected concerted activity under the National Labor Relations Act. Judge Ginsburg a couple times used the phrase that in this context, in the employment context, that there's no true liberty of contract. That's a quote that she used a couple of times. And that she called this, in fact, likened it to a yellow dog contract, you know, a contract where employees agree they won't join a union. And she said it was these type of contracts in this type of situation where an employee really has no meaningful choice that the NLRA was designed to protect. And so she thought that this, the right to engage in class or collective actions falls right in under the true reasons and protections of the NLRA. She used the phrase one time, you know, strength in numbers. She pointed to the fact that the Ernst & Young case involved an employee with a claim of, I believe, around $1,800. And she said, you know, you need the strength in numbers here and that protection in order to protect the employee's interest. Justice Kagan expressly said that the NLRA's protections sweep farther than the workplace. Justice Breyer, this is a pretty close quote, if not exactly spot on, that I wrote down, where he said, I haven't seen a way you can win talking to the employer's lawyer without undermining and changing radically the interpretations of the NLRA from years. And Sotomayor, Judge Sotomayor announced a similar stance. So after hearing the oral argument today, I think there is no question in my mind which direction the four, you know, more liberal justices are going to go in this case. They all seem to very clearly believe that class and collective actions are concerted activity under the NLRA, and that class, the NLRA, would fall neatly under the FAA's savings clause. That is, the FAA, the Federal Arbitration Act, requires that contracts be enforced according to their terms, but yet it does preserve general contract principles. It says, save upon such grounds that exist in law for the revocation of any contract. And I believe Justice Ginsburg, Justice Kagan, Justice Breyer, and Justice Sotomayor are going to have no problem finding that the NLRA falls neatly into the savings clause of the FAA, which preserves general contract principles that would serve for the revocation of any contract. The flip side, however, you know, I think it was also pretty clear from Justice Roberts, Justice Alito's position that they are going to come out on this issue on the side of the employers. You know, the Justice Ginsburg, Breyer, Kagan were trying very hard to get the lawyer for the employer, Mr. Clement, to make the concession that class or collective actions are protected activity under the Act and under the National Labor Relations Act. And he wouldn't make that concession. And I think both he and the Solicitor General said it doesn't matter. And they took the position, it really doesn't matter if you believe class or collective actions are protected concerted activity under the National Labor Relations Act. Because when you harmonize these two statutes, there's no clear contrary congressional command that would take the NLRA that would override the Federal Arbitration Act's mandate that arbitration agreements be enforced according to their terms. And that whenever this court, the Supreme Court, has tried to reconcile two federal statutes, that's the analysis that the court has used. Justice Sotomayor, I believe it was, pointed out, though, that those cases are a little bit different. In the past, when the court has attempted to reconcile two different statutes, the situation was a little different in that the analysis The analysis was whether or not a claim which arose under a federal statute was arbitrable. And she seemed to make a distinction here where you have the NLRA that, you know, I think according to the employees in the NLRB would provide a substantive right that protects employees from waiving any concerted activities. But I think that the employer stuck to the attorneys representing the employer and the solicitor general stuck to their guns, advocating for the position that, look, once the parties get to the courthouse steps into the court, the rules of the forum apply, and the terms in an arbitration agreement simply provide for the rules of procedure under which that arbitration agreement is to be enforced, and that a provision stating what parties are going to be involved in the arbitration or any of the rules for the arbitration is the same as a rule of civil procedure, and it should be treated the same. And at some point, I believe, I can't remember if it was Justice Alito or Justice Roberts, asked the general counsel for the NLRB, how he reconciled Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure against the NLRB's position that class or collective actions couldn't be waived. Because the argument is, well, if class or collective actions is truly protected concerted activity under the National Labor Relations Act, wouldn't a party who seeks decertification, for example, be guilty of violating the National Labor Relations Act simply by relying on the rules of procedure that allow you to do so? And to me, the NLRB made a surprising concession in the case, and that is that, look, for better or worse, the rules of the forum apply. And for better or worse, if you get to arbitration and the rules of the arbitration body or the forum, the American Arbitration American Arbitration Association, for example, if their rules prohibited class or collective actions, then for better or worse, that's what the employee would have to live with. Just like when an employee gets to court, they have to live with the rules of procedure that are set by the federal rules or state rules of civil procedure. So I thought that was an interesting concession. I think that, you know, when the general counsel for the NLRB was questioned about that position, and the general counsel stated that, look, in that situation, it's not the employer who would be prohibiting the employee from engaging in a protected concerted activity. That would simply be the rules of the forum. And so I think that though that Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, in my mind, based on their questions, didn't think that was a reconcilable position to take, because it would be very easy for an employer to simply put in an arbitration agreement that this will be governed by the rules of a particular forum, arbitration forum, that does not provide for class waivers. And I think even the comment was made to the general counsel that if that's their position, they're not going to get very far or change very much with that position. Another a couple of I thought, challenging questions from Justices Alito and Roberts for the NLRB's general counsel and for the lawyer representing the employees was, one, if the NLRB believes, and I think it's pretty clear the NLRB confirmed their position was, that arbitration agreements are enforceable in the employment context as long as they provide for class proceedings in some forum. And I think the NLRB's position is, as long as the employees can pursue class proceedings in arbitration or in court, the NLRB believes that the arbitration agreement does not violate the National Labor Relations Act. the question that was posed was this: if that's true, if that's their position and an employee can't waive it, how can that be reconciled with the employee allowing the employer or the employer affecting that right in any way? How can the employer dictate to the employee how they will engage in that protected activity or where they will engage in that protected activity, as in telling the employee they'll do it in arbitration as opposed to court? And I don't believe that the NLRB's general counsel addressed that question very well. It was left open-ended. The other question came up in challenging the NLRB's lawyer and the lawyer for the employees was, well, what if you simply had a provision in the agreement that stated a numerosity requirement that was consistent with the federal rules? Is that allowed? And I think all of these questions went to prove and to show that it was difficult to reconcile the NLRB's position in this case as it relates to clash of collective actions. Another, you know, just a few more interesting comments or issues that came up. I thought it was really interesting at some point. I believe it was when the lawyer for the solicitor from the Solicitor General's office was speaking and talking about reconciling the NLRA with the FAA and that there needing to be a clear contrary congressional command in order to override the mandate from the Federal Arbitration Act that agreements be enforced according to their terms. Justice Kagan's hypothetical was, well, what if you have an arbitration agreement that discriminates against certain groups of employees? What if the arbitration agreement provides that fees will be paid for men but not for women? How would you reconcile that with Title VII, for example? And I think it was a really good answer, and it was this, nothing having to do with arbitration, and the nature of arbitration doesn't have anything to do with discrimination. But the Supreme Court on many occasions has said the true nature of arbitration is a bilateral proceeding. And there's a difference between attempting to enforce a clearly discriminatory rule that has nothing to do with the essence of arbitration and reconciling another federal statute that really goes and contravenes the essence and fundamental nature of arbitration, which is supposed to be bilateral arbitration. So I thought that question was handled pretty well. Another interesting exchange that took place in the court, I believe, was this. And Justice Kennedy brought up that employees could still act concertedly by going to the same attorney, and they could get the benefits from the same attorney representing them in relation to the same matter. They just would need to file three separate proceedings, but it doesn't mean that they weren't engaging in protections afforded by the National Labor Relations Act. And a couple things were brought up in relation to that. Justice Kagan, for example, said, well, just because you still have some rights doesn't mean that you can dismiss others. Simply because the First Amendment allows for free speech and gives you certain rights of free speech, it doesn't mean that you can dismiss or people would lose their rights to handbill or use leaflets, those kinds of things. It was also interesting, I think it was Justice Ginsburg brought up that a lot of arbitration agreements have confidentiality provisions, and she thought those confidentiality provisions would affect and would stop employees from acting concertedly through separate arbitration proceedings. Those are really the highlights of the arguments that I had. You know, based on all of that, what do we know after the argument? I think it's this. I think we absolutely know that Justices Breyer, Kagan, Sotomayor, and Ginsburg are going to side with the NLRB's position in this case. After hearing oral argument, there's no doubt in my mind. There was some thought before oral argument that Justice Breyer maybe could be reached, but After hearing his comments and questions, I personally don't believe that that's the case. I also believe, based on the comments and questions, that Justices Alito and Justice Roberts, I believe, are going to side with the employer's position in this case. Interestingly, you know, everyone was anxious and curious to see what Justice Gorsuch, how he was going to come out, and what we could divine from his questions and comments during the hearing. And I don't recall him asking a single question or making a single comment. Justice Thomas, as usual, did not ask a single question or make a single comment. And, you know, as usual, Justice Kennedy, if there was one justice that I had a hard time figuring out which way he was going based on his comments and questions, it was his. And it's difficult to say, you know, given a few of his comments on concerted activity and what is or isn't concerted activity. If I had to bet, and if someone forced me to make a prediction, I would bet that he's going to side with the employers in this case. But really, the answer is who knows? It's going to be very close. I believe, you know, if you had to make me guess, I'd bet this is going to be 5-4, rejecting the NLRB's analysis and finding that class waivers are enforceable, notwithstanding the protections afforded by the National Labor Relations Act. But, you know, it's just my opinion, and take that for what it's worth. But those were the comments I have, kind of the high points of the oral argument, and I'm certainly happy to answer any questions anyone may have.
Well, thank you so much. Once again, this is Dean Reuter. Let's open the floor to questions at this point. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question, our lines are wide open at this point. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Before we turn to our first caller, let me, I think the observation's already been made. October term 2017 has opened, and as our custom here, we'll be covering a lot of Supreme Court oral arguments the day they are argued through our teleform conference calls. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. is our next scheduled conference call. We'll be talking about the Wesby case at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. Of course, today we're talking about FAA versus, that is not the Federal Aviation Administration, but the Federal Arbitration Act versus the NLRA. We've got one caller on the line, then our lines are open. Push the star button, and then the pound button. But now let's go to our first caller.
Good afternoon. I was wondering if it flips the other way, if it's 5-4 in favor of the NLRB's position, what impact is that going to have on all of these, I assume, a lot of employers that do have arbitration agreements limiting class actions?
You know, thank you. It's a good question. I believe when Mr. Ortiz, the lawyer for the employees, was giving his presentation, he started out with some statistics about how prevalent arbitration agreements and class waivers are in American workforce today. And the justices asked him specifically the following question, that is, so if we rule in your favor, we're going to invalidate 25 million contracts between employers and employees. And he said yes. And so that's the biggest effect, and I can't imagine that the court is going to lightly do that. But a couple of other things if the court finds that class waivers are unenforceable. Number one, everyone needs to keep in mind this only applies to non-supervisory employees covered by the National Labor Relations Act. And for example, the definition of supervisor is different between the National Labor Relations Act and the Fair Labor Standards Act, for example. So it doesn't vitiate all class waivers, just those with non-supervisory employees. Number two, the NLRB General Counsel's position that if the rules of the forum provide for no class actions, which is what I understood when he was giving his presentation, it would seem to me that if the arbitration organization doesn't exist right now that doesn't provide for class or collective actions, there's going to be a whole bunch popping up sooner rather than later if that's the way the law goes in this situation. The other big issue that wasn't addressed by this court, because none of these contracts at issue had an opt-out provision, is whether or not an opt-out provision, a provision that allows an employee to voluntarily opt out of the agreement within a certain amount of time, whether or not that would preserve a class action waiver. The Ninth Circuit has said it does, that by virtue of making it completely voluntary, that the if your agreement has an opt-out provision, that your class waiver is nevertheless enforceable. It's very likely that that issue is going to be open even after the court rules, if the court in fact rules that class waivers do violate the National Labor Relations Act. So that's another area of hope for employers in the event that the Supreme Court goes in favor of the National Labor Relations Board's position.
Once again, if you have a question, our lines are wide open. We don't have any callers in the queue. Push the star button, then the pound button to indicate you have a question. I'll ask a question while we wait to see who else might ring in. You mentioned the new Solicitor General and the fact that the government, at least that part of the government, had changed its position here. I wonder if you could say a few words about why the NLRB General Counsel didn't change positions. I assume that person serving under a term. The NLRB has its own litigation authority, and this position has not been filled by the new Trump administration. Can you say something about that?
That is correct. So the Richard Griffin, the acting general counsel of the NLRB, was appointed by President Obama. His term is up, I believe, at the end of this year. And as a general counsel, you know, he gets to dictate the policies and the path of the NLRB. You know, and it's his call. And obviously it was his call to continue to pursue this particular stance on behalf of the board. Who knows whether that's going to change, regardless of how the Supreme Court rules. Who knows what the NLRB will do in the future with the new appointees by President Trump. So a lot of things are changing. I mean, presumably there's going to be a new general counsel that is going to be more like-minded with the position of the Solicitor General today, as opposed to that of the GC of the NLRBs today. So there's no telling what's going to happen in the future, but you're exactly right that the general counsel is the holdover from the Obama administration, and he's therefore continuing to advocate that position.
I'm curious what happens if the Supreme Court hasn't reached a decision on this case before there's a new general counsel, and the new general counsel appointed by Trump announces that he's joining the Solicitor General's view here. Does that moot the case, or does the Supreme Court still decide the case, or is that such an uncommon thing that there's really not a lot of precedent there?
Boy, it's certainly uncommon. I suppose in theory, the general counsel, if there's a new general counsel, they could potentially withdraw the petition. Because remember, the board lost at the Fifth Circuit and then sought cert before the Supreme Court. I guess in theory, they could try to withdraw the case, but you've still got the other two cases up there with the identical issue, Epic Systems and Ernst & Young. So I don't think it would have an effect at this point on the decision in the case.
Interesting. Once again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button. Our lines are wide open. I'll continue to ask a question or two while we wait to see if the audience gets more engaged here. You mentioned the new Solicitor General. The acting Solicitor General has been Jeff Wall. The new Solicitor General, Noel Francisco. Who actually argued the case? Was it one of them or somebody else? On behalf
it was
of the government.
Jeffrey Wall that argued the case, yeah.
Right. Well, that makes sense since he sort of briefed it, I suppose. But it was under Jeff Wall that the Solicitor General's office changed its position. Is that correct? We haven't had Noel Francisco in that seat for more than two or three weeks, I think.
That is correct. I believe it was back in June, that sometime this summer, that the amicus brief was filed on behalf of the United States.
Right. And one final question I have, but let me remind the audience, you're free to ask questions. If you push the star button, then the pound button. Otherwise, we'll adjourn the call after my few questions here. Three consolidated cases. A lot of folks mentioning, you mentioned, engaged in the argument here. It got argument time. Did this all happen within 1 hour, or did they have extended argument time this morning for these cases?
It all happened within 1 hour. I did not watch my clock that closely to see how it was divided up. It's based on just what I heard. It seemed to be relatively equal amount of time that everyone had to argue, but it was an hour.
Mm-hmm. And then my final question, again, if you're in the audience, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. And this is more a question about the court maybe than this case in particular, so you might not even want to guess at this. But sometimes we get these blockbuster cases that are so important and the court's so divided, you won't get a decision until the last day of the term or the last week of the term as they're deciding their largest cases or the most controversial cases, I would suppose. Does this strike you as that sort of case where it'll be a long time in the decision-making process here and we won't see the court's opinion until next calendar year and maybe closer to the end of the term?
You know, I definitely think it's one of the types of cases that has a lot of issues involved in it. I think it presents challenging issues. I think it is the type of case where each side feels very strongly about. I think it has become somewhat of at least a political issue now, and I think it's going to be difficult to decide. I do. I think that all that said, who knows when a decision is going to come out. I really couldn't say how all that will affect the decision, but it certainly is a case that's not a simple one, and there's certainly viable arguments on both sides of the table.
Right. Very good. One final question I've come up with here since we have you online, since you were in the courtroom this morning. I don't know if you stuck around for the other argument, but I'm just curious if you did Gorsuch, Justice Gorsuch, ask any questions or make any comments during that?
I can't say. I left after the first argument.
Right. Fair enough. Let me make a final call for questions here. If you have a question for our expert, push the star button and the pound button on your phone. I think we've had our final question. So I want to thank you for not only taking the time to be with us today, but of course taking the time to make arrangements for and to be in the oral argument. This is a fascinating discussion. I look forward to seeing the opinion. So thank you for joining us today. Thanks to the audience as well for calling in. It's great to have so many of you on the line on this, the first day of the term. A reminder to our audience to check our new website, just launched last week, and also your emails for upcoming Teleforum calls. The next call is scheduled tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, this same number. We'll be talking about a Supreme Court case to be argued tomorrow. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.